Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Women Scholars and Professionals podcast. My name is Anne Boyd, and I'll be your host. We at Women Scholars and Professionals are here to support women in their God-given callings into the university and beyond. So if you're a graduate student or a faculty member, an administrator or a student in professional school, a scholar in between jobs, or simply a person who supports women in the academic world, then this podcast is for you. How can we open ourselves to the opportunities for theological education all around us, whether or not we are in seminary? Author and educator Dr. Maria Liu Wong joins us on the podcast to discuss her book, On Becoming Wise Together, Learning and Leading in the City. This book is part of a 12-volume series with the Theological Education Between the Times Project, a diverse initiative that explores the changing landscape of theological education. Maria offers her own rich life experiences as a medium through which she tunes into the theological lessons God has for her as she digs deeply into the stories of her family, her friends, and her community. I loved the way Maria's viewpoint opens us to the constant presence of the Holy Spirit and the ways we're continually being shaped by the relationships and communities that we're part of. Maria's voice is distinctive and wise, and I think you'll really enjoy learning from her. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll hear an excerpt from our conversation where Maria shares some tips about integrating the work of parenting into one's academic calling. So let me tell you a little bit more about her. Maria Liu Wong is provost of City Seminary of New York and co-directs a major national initiative there, Ministry in the City Hub. She is the co-author of Stay in the City, How Christian Faith is Flourishing in an Urban World. So let's dive right in. We're so glad you're here. I want to talk about your book, On Becoming Wise Together. But first, I would love to start by asking you a few questions about your professional life. So you are currently the provost of City Seminary of New York, and you have a lot of experience in theological education. So I would just love to begin by asking you to tell the story of your path into this field.
Okay. Well, it certainly wasn't straight. I started out in undergrad majoring in English literature and environmental science, and came out thinking I did not want to be in an office. So it was either going to be in a classroom or in a forest. So then I got in to Teach for America and ended up in the South Bronx. And because I had majored in science, I was slated to teach secondary science, which I wasn't super thrilled about. I don't know if secondary school, that level was, the kids were bigger than me, literally. So, but on my resume, I had played violin for many years through college, and the AP at the interview said, "Would you like to teach music?" I said, "Okay." So I started as a music teacher for 3-4 years in a school in the Bronx, and eventually was doing grad school while I was teaching. And that was in international educational development at Teachers College at Columbia. And then ended up going to Ethiopia for a year, coming back, teaching primary school, first grade in the Brooklyn at a charter school. So all of this is a very circuitous route right now. Then got married, had a baby, went to seminary with my husband. We decided to do the Urban Mission Program that Westminster Seminary was doing in New York with City Seminary. And so the three of us, my husband and my baby and I, went through seminary together for 3 years. And during that time, I started working part-time teaching in graduate school, and then eventually started to work with adults. So then I started working part-time for City Seminary the year
Mm-hmm.
before I graduated. And Mark just knew that I was just helping to kind of administer the MA program. And then I ended up doing my doctorate in adult learning and leadership and thinking about pedagogy and curriculum. And we basically started to dream together with a growing community of graduates that became part of our faculty. What would it look like if we had a seminary that was for New Yorkers by New Yorkers in New York? And so City Seminary was born from that dream to kind of rethink, what would it look like if our average student wasn't necessarily the one person going to get their MDiv, and we actually decided not to do an MDiv. We did a master's to kind of open up the space for who our student might be. And so that's, I don't know, 17, 18 years ago.
Wow.
So that was that was a long time ago. And I've had the privilege of really growing with the community. And now we're in our maybe second season of leadership, I would say. I think I've been able to pass on some of the things that I started to others, and it's really been exciting to see our community begin to grow in that way. So I guess what we're doing is interesting because I also have been serving on the board of directors for the Association of Theological Schools as a public member, and I was part of this series that this book is a part of. So, that's my experience in theological education.
Well, it's a great story, and this kind of your circuitous route of landing where you did. We hear often from our listeners and readers stories like this where, you take one turn and then you see what's around the bend. And so it's great to hear your path and to be witness to God's faithfulness to you as you followed him along the journey. So, as you reflect on your life in theological education and thinking about education, what have been some of the gifts of that, of this career, and what have been some of the challenges for you?
I think some of the biggest gifts have been the people that I have come to grow with, learn from, and call friends. Because so much of our work at the seminary is community-based, we're in learning communities and cohorts, we co-teach. I think grown as a person and knowing who I am, who God has made me, who I am with others because of the conversations and the different experiences that I've had with colleagues and friends. So, yeah, the people have been a really rich part of being able to enjoy what I do. I think the other thing is the space to be creative. And last year I was at AAR and just listening to different presentations, and I understand how academia can be very exhausting. But I think I've been in some peer mentor groups as well with colleagues who are in more traditional institutions. And I think maybe the gift of being or choosing to be in a different type of institution or building a different institution has been that space to be creative, to the space to do things in a different way that doesn't have as much restriction or constraint. We created a community arts gallery, and arts-based and experiential pedagogies are kind of what our entire institution does, not just one person or a couple of people. So I think that because of that, my own journey, I've been able to, I guess, not be bored in what I'm doing, because as we have grown and I've maybe passed things off, or I've really seen others step up into leadership, then I've moved into other spaces and been able to try out new things. And I don't know, I feel like that's been such a privilege to be able to have space to be creative and to have support. I've really appreciated the support along the way. My colleague Mark, who's the director, he He's given me a pretty wide bandwidth, or like just, okay, sure, do that. And he doesn't know what that's going to mean. It could be like an arts residency in like London, or and it all comes back to kind of the different ways we're kind of leaning into learning and being together differently. So yeah, I think that's creativity, space, and the people. So challenges. Well, doing a new thing is always challenging because it takes a lot of entrepreneurial spirit, and I think not everybody is, up for the ways that you have to. I mean, I grew up in a as an MK, so it's like you learn to live by faith and you learn to do a lot with very little, and you were trusting in God. So, I mean, we've had harder seasons and learned a lot from that. So yeah, not everything's always been rosy, but I think God has really taught us to lean more into God, into our call as an organization, as a community, and for me, leaning into who I am in that context when I'm working with others. So yeah, I think maybe just one other challenge has been to have to be more active or intentional about finding peers. I'm so often in spaces where I'm the only me in the room, and there isn't, like, I know there are other people out there, but I don't always see them in the particular spaces that I'm in. And so I've found different ways to have like small groups of peer mentors and others to be my conversation partners. And because I think my experiences and my interests are so kind of diverse, it's been it's been an effort to find people in those different places to, I don't know that anybody really gets me in my entirety. I mean, I'm sure that's the case for everybody, but yeah, like finding someone else who's also trying to figure out how to build a new institution and that kind of thing. So yeah.
Well, I would love to hear also what advice you might have for a young seminary student or a new faculty person, with your experience. What tips or advice would you give them?
I think maybe the most important thing is not thinking that you are alone on your journey, that you come from people and you are with others who really care about you and have formed you. So I think even though you might have your particular interest, journey, vocation, lean into the support that is around you that may not you may it may not be as visible at certain times. Find a conversation partner to learn with and to kind of process with. Find those groups, I think, because they are there, and it just takes one or two people to that you can, walk with when something happens, and that you say, like, this just happened to me. Am I crazy or is this real? And then to be able to have those kind of checks and balances to, your experiences in academia, because sometimes things happen and you're like, what? That didn't really happen, did it? And then you need to be with people who know you and love you and support you and say, like, hey, that did, and let's try to figure out how to respond to that or just grieve whatever experience it might be. I think I've been actually it's I'm in this weird space where I'm not really a senior person, but in some senior spaces, and I'll go to AR and I'll be meeting with some like doctoral students or new faculty, and really just trying to encourage them to also sometimes they want to do more than their context allows, let's say. And so in some of those like smaller peer mentoring spaces, I think I've been able to, I hope, be an encouragement for others who feel they're a little bit more constrained, and to think about creative things they can do within their own classroom that feels true to themselves and to what they're doing, and encourage them to be creative about even within their own institutions as they're teaching. It might be their formal coursework, but there are other spaces within their organizations or in their communities that they can find life-giving expressions of their gifts. So I think that's what I would say to students and early faculty.
That's lovely. Thank you. Well, I'm really excited to talk with you about your book. And the title is On Becoming Wise Together, Learning and Leading in the City. And it's a book that feels like we are taking a journey alongside you. And it's filled with stories and art and reflection. And all of it really leads us into considering a broader view of theological education. So there's so many things I want to ask, but I want to start by asking you about autoethnographic methodology, this methodology that you use for your research, which I really loved. It just seems to help the reader think more expansively about theological education, and about our world. So can you help us understand this methodology a little better for people who aren't familiar with it?
Sure. Well, just backing up a little, we had the freedom in this series to, and we worked together as a series. There's 12 of us. There were 12 of us to think about genre. And I knew I was in the group because of my work with the seminary. And another person in that group kind of wrote a more historical narrative of her institution. But I felt that just as I had done in my doctoral studies, my dissertation ended up being on women in leadership and global theological education, that my own voice and my story was important to be out there and to be able to be an encouragement to others coming after me who, because I had limited role models, let's say, in my own journey. And I think being able to say that your lived experience is important to unpack. There are stories in your experience that you can really mine and glean so much out of that kind of point to a wider reality. So being able to kind of look back and think about stories where you learn lessons, but these are not, I mean, you're not alone. I'm not alone. So I think autoethnography is not just like saying, oh, this is the story of my life. It's a memoir. It's a, autobiography. But it is thinking about it with like a researcher's lens and like what's there, what is coming out, what needs to be interrogated and examined with some honesty and critical eye, because my story is actually a part of a whole diaspora community's story. And I think that being able to share more of those stories and claim that our voice and our experience and perspectives, which have not always been heard or seen, are important to bring to light. And so I think autoethnography was taking that kind of personal into more of a political or a, a different space to say that this is important to know about our experience and what it points to in wider realities. And also because I remember being in grad school and I did a whole project on like teaching and diversity in our program because I did not see myself reflected in a lot of the curricula. And I said, I know there's people like me out there. And I think that's maybe been a part of my journey of saying, I know there's people like me out there. And because this dominant way of presenting is in text, we're not there unless someone reads about us.
Right.
So I think this was a way to say this is a really rich way of understanding experiences that maybe are not yours, but can help you to begin to unpack someone else's experience, even as you reflect on your own. So
I would love to back up to talk a little bit more broadly about theological education. This study, the theological education, it's certainly important for people who are called into ministry, but I am guessing that you would agree that it's also important for every Christian. And I think your book helps us to think about ways that we are experiencing theological learning and education all the time. So can you help us to unpack what theological education means for every Christian, and maybe, just the listeners on the podcast who are not in seminary, who are not in that kind of training?
Sure. I think I see theological education really in Like, this is my edu speak, like non-formal, informal, and formal. So essentially, all of us who can recognize God's call in our lives to respond and live out our Christian identity, our lives in the world, we are formed in some way. And that starts in our families and extends into friendship conversations and community life and church life. And I think we put theological education in a box when we think it's just seminary, when we think it's just that graduate education, it's just that like formal thing that will bring us to XYZ. And I'm not saying, of course, that formal theological education is not important, but it's much more than that. It's what's happening in churches, outside of churches, in communities, in conversations around the dinner table. And to be able to be attentive to that actually being formation, spiritual formation. And I think when my husband and I wanted to go to seminary, it wasn't because we wanted to be the pastor. We wanted just to, he's a social worker as a teacher. We just wanted to go deeper and really understand how our decisions, our choices, and living out our life were really grounded on a deeper understanding of who God is and how God works in the world. And I think that theological education means paying attention to all of the sources that shape you spiritually, theologically, and seeing that the questions you're asking as a parent or as a student or is a theological reflection in practice. So I mean, it's thinking about theology as an activity rather than something that is in a book that is passed down to you that you need to know, and that's the right way. But it's discernment and understanding that you are doing theology every day. You are asking questions, and you're trying to also learn from how other people did it. But it helps you to, I think, with intention, think about how God is leading you and your community and your family, and recognizing that formative process sometimes means that you have to make decisions that push you in a way that you wouldn't necessarily go. And I think for us at City Seminary, because we are a theological learning community that is diverse intentionally, so we have Christians of different backgrounds and languages and cultures, that we start to kind of grapple with like what we know to be true is not always like someone else's true or norm. And then how do we understand how, the gospel truth is inherent in different cultures and is turned toward Christ and how that might look differently. And so when we start to ask those in a community, and that's why I think community is so important, then we begin to see our own biases and our own prejudices. And not to say that like the way that God has formed us in our particular location place is not important, but it's not the only way. So we talk about the Ephesian moment at the seminary. The late missiologist Andrew Walls, he talked about, there's no one part of the church that has a corner on, Christ. It's like we need each other to be complete. And so I think thinking about theological formation and recognizing all the different spaces where we're being asked to see where the gospel is relevant, in maybe unexpected places, then we begin to see how the truth of God's presence everywhere really is there. You can see it, you can recognize it, you can name it, and you can examine it, and you can wonder how God has been has is there where you might not have expected. So.
One of the things that I really appreciated about your writing and your reflection was your thoughts on leadership. It was really refreshing. You write in one chapter, "I have lived my life creatively resisting how others perceive me and their ideas of what might be broadly defined as a leader." I'm just wondering, can you say a little bit more about how you have uncovered your own leadership gifts in ways that are authentic for you?
Well, I grew up being the little girl in the classroom who never raised her hand. Every parent-teacher conference was, Maria really needs to raise her hand. And it's really ironic because I have that same conversation with my kids' teachers. And, this Participation as an educator, of course, is important. But I think there's always this idea of a leader as the person in front of the room who speaks. It's the loudest person, it's the most dominant person. And I will have to say that's not my personality. I prefer to like create the space and not be in front of the room. I do it if I have to. And I think the biggest joke, God said, "Oh, you don't like public speaking? Great. Go do it for your life, I have these conversations with my daughter because she's like also quiet and doesn't want to be in front. And I'm like, it's practice, and God makes you do things that are uncomfortable sometimes, but then you realize it's not you, and God will use you. Like, didn't God use Moses and Aaron? And they weren't very comfortable with it, but I think I also, that makes me attentive to what I need to be doing in my classroom or in any setting that I'm curating an experience. Let's say whether it's in the gallery or on the street in a PBB or whatever, that there are people who are showing up in very different ways. And giving it an opportunity for each of those people in this classroom to lead means making space for them to show up and do things in different ways so that they can feel like, oh, I'm really able to, in a nonverbal way, contribute to this space, and as a learner and a leader. And so I see those two things as kind of really working hand in hand, because we're always learning how to lead. And as we lead, we're learning about ourselves. So I think that creating spaces where I can and others can feel like we are contributing and leading into our gifts as God has given us, in ways that might not be always seen as the dominant model, I think is important to make those spaces to think about, like, collaborative leading. That's often not the first thing you think about, but hey, what if it meant like one person didn't have all the things that you need to be a leader? And often, you have those competency checklists, like this person needs to, I mean, some people do, but not everybody does. And sometimes you really need everybody in the room to get to a certain experience or understanding, and to recognize that the knowledges in the room are located in different places, and that you will grow, we will grow together when we can make room for and give permission for those other ways of leading to be acknowledged. And I think it is kind of, go back to the community thing. There's a very Western way of, like, it's the one person. And I think my resistance is like, yeah, I am one person, but I am not just me. Actually, I represent my family, I represent my community. And so I am me with others, and that's what I bring into the room, as do all the other people. And so when you have more than one person, or even more than one person, like, you have more than one. So I think leading can be related to the ways that we show up and do and be. And there need to be more spaces where those types of leading can be recognized and affirmed. I think when people are affirmed for not being the loudest, and but can lead in completely different ways. I realize I've been in a couple of spaces, I can't say always, that where I show up better because, we didn't have to do all these like large group debriefs, but I got to talk meaningfully with my partner, and then we were able to share in, like, that helped me to lead and give my voice, lean, like, lend my voice into this d important discussion. But it wasn't always like, okay, everybody, what do you think? I mean, that's like awful to me. I'm like, oh, dead silence. So for me, as a leader educator, it's like, how do we encourage the partners, the small groups, the nonverbal, the different ways of accessing and communicating that help everybody to feel like they can really share who they are, but not in the one way, but in the many ways. So.
You're describing your experience very graciously and kind of delicately, but I remember from your book that you've really had to push back against some experiences of racism and sexism. That's part of your story too. Do you want to say anything about what that was like?
I guess it's just normal to me. Like, people don't expect things. I've had various students who, like, early on when I was the dean, I was like, "You're the dean, but you're not XYZ." And I was like, "What do you expect a dean to be?" I think also I'm generally a very informal person. I can be very, proper and serious, and all when it need to be. But generally I'm fairly personable, and that can sometimes lead others to not recognize, the work that has come behind, all that I've got, gotten to. So I think some the strikes against me looking young, oh my goodness, you have a child in college? I'm like, yes, I do. And I did not get married in my early 20s, so I am who I am. Yeah, and expecting that a woman wouldn't be in this position, or that an Asian person has, yeah, I've been in places where, they look at me, they're trying to figure it out, and then I open up my mouth and I don't have an accent. I've been told I have a Midwestern accent, which is funny because I was born in England, grew up in Long Island. I do not have a Long Island accent and have lived many years in Manhattan. So I don't know why I have a Midwestern accent. But yeah, people on the phone don't always, well, before Zoom, didn't know like what to expect when they saw me. And so I think I've spent so much of my life kind of debunking what people think I could be or might be, that it's just now like it's just normal to like, okay, I'm just gonna say, this is who I am. And I know that I'm probably just kind of, going through the checklist of like, no, I'm not that, no, I'm not that, no, I'm that. So yeah, I think racism and sexism is just a part of being in this world, and you could either get crushed by it, get resentful, or just be burned and just become cynical, or just realize that people are who they are because of their experiences. Try to have a little empathy and say like, well, this is not who I am, and can we grow into a relationship so where you know who I am, and that might help you to better understand where I come from, and vice versa with others. So yeah, I think when I was writing this, I was encouraged to maybe push a little bit more critical, but I think I come from this, I have these three words, like an idealist, optimist, and pragmatist lens of the world. And I know that really hard and horrible things happen, and but I don't know, God has just like put in this like layer of hope even in the darkest stuff, that I seem to lean into. I don't know. That's just how I've, yeah.
Well, it's great to hear your experience. Thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. I want to turn now and ask about this phrase that you introduce early in the book, and then I saw it repeated a few times, throughout the book. And it's this term, joy work. Can you tell us a little bit about this and, where it comes from and what it means for our lives?
I first heard the term from Willie Jennings when we were having those meetings talking about our books and our work in theological education. And it really stuck with me, that, what is the, we talked a lot about what's the telos or the telos of theological education. And if it does not bring us to joy, then why? What? So I think this idea that what underlies the meaning and purpose of our work needs to have a direction. And if anything, joy is something that I would hope we'd aspire to, even if it's aspirational seasonally, or but in a broken world, if joy is not something we can experience, then it is a hopeless world. It is a dark, horrible place that we cannot, that it's harder to kind of hold on to truth and light when things just are really hard. And so to imagine and think about what we do in life, whatever. I mean, it could be a theological education, it could be also in whatever else you do, to think of it as joy work. It's not happiness work. It's not like I feel good, but joy is this pervasive, underlying, it is because of who we are in Christ. It just enables us to sustain through seasons of dry and seasons of abundance. But it is something that if we can conceive of our doing, our activity and being and becoming, with this openness to how the Holy Spirit can bubble up, then I think that makes it easier to get up and then get out and then do what you need to do, because there's that behind it. So it's joy work because you're looking forward to where this leads. What is that undercurrent behind it? What is it for?
Well, Maria, this has been so lovely. Can you tell the readers how they can follow you and your work and maybe what's on the horizon for your future?
So I've been doing this national work. Really excited that we're having an art exhibition, a traveling art exhibition that's opening in March in Santa Ana, and that was out of this work of bringing eight social practice artists together to think about community and care and faith and learning during the pandemic. And so that's an exhibition that'll be there and then in other places. So in this season, I've been really excited to be able to bring the arts and art affirm more artists and seeing their work as bridging church and community. So that's going on. And what I just started last summer is a kind of a 5-year re-listening to what's going on with faith and families in New York City. So this is a much more kind of on the ground listening circles, hearing, talking to parents in immigrant diaspora congregations, and again lifting up the thing that the experience of people that aren't always included in these national surveys, but documenting, because I'm realizing that my work, I guess, in this stage of life is documenting and making visible experiences of folks that haven't always been seen or heard. And so whether it's arts or in different immigrant communities, I think it's a really wonderful season to be doing this work. So
Maria's expansive view of God's activity and readiness to train us gives me great hope for kingdom purposes in the world. I am excited about the ways my own vision has grown through Maria's work and writing. I hope you check out her book, which you can find wherever books are sold. And if you listen to the end of the credits, you'll get to hear a bonus from our podcast where Maria talks about integrating the work of parenting into one's academic calling. The Women Scholars and Professionals podcast is hosted by me, Anne Boyd, and is a production of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We acknowledge that the opinions of our guests may not necessarily represent the ministry, doctrine, or policies of InterVarsity. You can find more information about our podcast and the other cool things we are doing at thewell.intervarsity.org. Our work is funded solely through the donations of our listeners and supporters. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you might consider joining our support team by donating even $10 per month. You can find out how to do this at our website. To ensure others will find and enjoy our podcast as well, please consider rating and reviewing our podcast and sharing it with others. And as we close, listen in on this excerpt from my conversation with Maria. I know that many of our listeners juggle work and parenting, and I really love the way that your stories showed how you were integrating family into your life and learning. So I would just love for you to say a little bit more about this.
Sure. I think it comes to back to, embracing who you are when you are, where you are. As a parent, in whatever season, there's work and there's family, and I think family be Because I grew up in a home where ministry was like very dominant and in our home all the time, and maybe my parents made different choices because we were a different generation of thinking about that. I think I grew up just wanting to make my own or different choices with my husband, about how family was our primary ministry, but also had options when with parents who are both in ministry to not always have to be doing what we were doing, you know, to have their space as well as our space. But then, you know, there were times where, you know, I remember being like 37 weeks pregnant at my doctoral interview, and the interviewers were like, "Oh my gosh, why now?" Well, if I don't do it now, there's gonna, you know, when am I gonna do it? There's no good time. So I think God, you know, meets you in the seasons of your life when you are wrestling with, like, I had my son, and when I started doctoral work, my classes, he was 6 months old. And my advisor at that time, there were no nursing rooms. So my advisor gave up his office so I could pump, you know, twice a day for the 3 week intensive. And he's like, you know, I'm a grandfather. I support you trying to be a mom, a good mom. And I also had my third kid between defending my proposal and my first semester of field work. And I think I just learned to let go of, you know, being in charge of everything and knowing that God was going to take care of our kids. My husband has a really, really good relationship with all the kids because, you know, he spent a whole lot of time. I was the one traveling, or, you know, sometimes I brought them with me. So I think the idea of surrender to, you can't be the perfect this, you can't be the super that. You understand your constraints within a season, and you know that God is in control, and the kids, you're just stewarding those kids. You're not in charge of them entirely. And sometimes they will grow to have a much richer experience because they have a grandparent or an auntie or an uncle or someone who's caring for them. Well, you can't be that person. But there are also seasons of parenting where you can have more of a presence in their lives. You know, I look back at those stories. I mean, my kid, I've got a kid in college and high school and middle school now, and it's a whole different season of parenting. And it's less of the, you know, when they're babies, you know, that physical kind of like gotta clean, gotta feed, but it's that this emotional presence of being with them. My husband is does also does counseling, and I a couple of last year I also did like kind of a counseling fellows program, just to kind of understand a little bit better about counseling and realizing that everything goes back to family origin.
It's
And
a lot of
so,
pressure.
but just thinking like, you know, we're never going to be perfect parents, but I think if we can really invest in being present when we can, and I do have more traveling in my schedule than I think my family would like, but trying to be present when I am home and involve them in, you know, this is what I'm doing, and knowing that, like, yeah, there will be times where I feel like I'm not doing great as a mom, but my husband's doing great as a dad, and you know, there are different roles that will play and as they grow up. And I don't know, don't beat yourself up so much, you know. I think, to be honest, like, lean into the community that you have. Know that God has put you in this season, and you can do what you can do, and that God loves you and your family, and will bring people around you. And don't be afraid to ask for help. I think we always want to do everything, and we can't be the perfect hostess, the perfect this and that, you know. And you know, sometimes there's just a deadline and you have to meet it, and like your kid is having a fever that night and you're just like writing the paper while you're like Motrin and like, you know, and it might not be the best paper in the world. Got done, your kid survived, you know, and that's okay. You know, and we just move on, and we know that God is shaping us in all of these experiences to be more resilient parents. And yeah, so surrender, resilience, being okay, And knowing that, there's a much bigger picture of like your family that's happening, that you don't have control of, but God sees, and it's like, oh yeah, I've got someone there right for you when you have, and I think for me, I've always seen like God is really good at making space for the no that I cannot say. And there's like a day where I'm like, oh, I have too much and I won't be able to, and then things get canceled. I'm like,
Right.
thank you God, because I couldn't say
Yes.
that no. So thank God that we're not in charge of our lives. Goodness me, if like, if we were, that would be like horrible, but God knows what we can handle, and so provides. Yeah, God provides when we just don't have any more.